Hello and welcome to On the Page. It's the podcast that accompanies the Writers Festival of Belgium. Today we've got a great conversation with a longtime Brussels journalist, Tony Connolly, very well known in Ireland, but also in Brussels, as he works for the Irish broadcaster RTE, who in 2016 wrote a book that came out in 2017 about Brexit. And then he goes through and explains why he needed to write an update in 2018. As you can imagine, he could infinitely keep writing updates, but it's an interesting look at how a correspondent in Brussels had to explain the implications for his country, which ended up being almost like a blueprint for a lot of us to understand what was happening with Brexit. Enjoy. When did you get to Brussels?
Well, that's a long time ago. I came to Brussels November the 11th, 2001. Yeah, right. So I came like just 2 months after 9/11. I had just been I had spent a month in Pakistan, in Peshawar, waiting for the American invasion, I guess, of Afghanistan, covering the immediate fallout of after September 11th. And then I came back and I did the interview for the job, and they sent me on the 11th of November, 2001. So yeah, it's a long time.
Do you remember anything about that day?
I do. I remember very clearly the day I arrived, because
everything was closed.
Everything was closed, absolutely. So not simply because it was a Sunday, but because there had been a lot of turbulence in the airline sector. I think Sabena, the Belgian airline, had kind of collapsed or was being taken over, and there was a strike. Now, I'd had a leaving due in Dublin on the night before I left, and I was extremely hungover the day I was traveling. And I just remember thinking on the plane that, okay, I'm just going to take all my suitcases, put them in a cab, go straight to my new apartment, which I'd already booked, and go to bed. But I arrived, and A, there were no taxis, and B, there weren't even any trolleys. They had locked all the trolleys off, so I had to carry like loads of suitcases in a really hungover state, and then try and figure out how to get to my apartment with no taxis. So I had to take like a train and a bus and a taxi, and
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. And
pleasure.
Of course, it's Tony Connolly from RTE. If you can. Maybe can you tell us a bit about the broadcaster for those that maybe aren't familiar with it, which I'm sure most people listen
to.
Yeah,
sure. I mean, RTE is the Irish public broadcaster. It's been in operation, oh God, I think since maybe
1920, something I was reading today.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So it's a public service broadcaster, and it... We don't have a huge network of foreign correspondents. We have somebody in London, and somebody in New York, somebody in Washington, me in Brussels. We have a correspondent in Warsaw, kind of covering Eastern Europe, and then we have a correspondent in Nairobi, covering the African continent. We try to project a footprint as best we can, and I cover. All of European news as best I can, and that's increasingly extended to the Middle East. So it's TV and radio online, and last week I had to shoot 6 piece to cameras for Instagram and TikTok.
Wow.
It was on the European Parliament election, so we cover every platform.
You do that yourself?
No, I had a cameraman with me.
Oh, okay, I see. But you have to organize it for that.
Yeah.
You know that it's for that platform.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating, which jumps straight up. That was going to be more towards the end, but I was going to say, so how has journalism changed since you started? Because I think you also started at newspapers, if I'm not.
Yeah, so I started. I started in newspapers back in the day. My first newspaper job was in Oxfordshire, a small local paper there, which I spent a year there. It was a very memorable kind of full immersion baptism of journalism. into a small town outside Oxford. So that gave me a great grounding, great fun as well. I mean, I worked with some great people, some of whom I'm still in touch with. Shireen Wheeler, actually, who you know.
Oh, right.
We she worked together on that newspaper,
Because when I mentioned her that you would be part this year, hopefully she will too. She's been very busy, she hasn't it, but she had been like, I should be the one interviewing Tony on the festival. Because you don't know this, but we used to work on desks across from each other on this
table. That's right.
Please be my guest. I would love that.
And that was at a time when we used typewriters and betraying my age here and carbon.
Lino
sheets and there were spikes on the desk for stories. You know, once you were finished your story. So then I moved into TV and radio, and I guess that obviously social media has changed everything and online journalism. So everything we do now in RTE has to have a digital first component. So even though a lot of my physical logistical effort every day is for television, you know, either doing lives or cutting a 2-minute news package for TV or radio, everything has to sort of translate across to social media, to Twitter or, well, online. But I find I find from an EU perspective, being able to write longer analysis pieces on the RTE website has been a great sort of departure because, you know, the maxim, as you probably know, for Brussels journalists is, you know, we don't report the news, we explain the news because the EU policy evolution is, you know, is a very complex and detailed creature, and, you know, to be able to explain it properly and all of the nuances of it and what position and how the commission works, it's great to have the, you know, the space to explain it properly online. I mean, there's no kind of, you don't hit a wall in terms of the duration. And during the Brexit negotiations, I found that was a fantastic outlet for me because I could get into the real detail of the Brexit negotiations. I would write these long pieces on a Saturday and, you know, really try and take the time to explain to people what was happening. And I think there was a market developed for that and people appreciated it.
We should get straight into the book, actually, because I'd ask you questions about journalism forever. But we'll get to that at another point. So the book is about Brexit. This is your second book, if I'm not mistaken.
It was the second book,
The first one that's about stereotypes and...
Yeah, the first one was a book I wrote about European stereotypes, which was, it feels like from a different era before. It was kind of before a lot of the big crises that hit the EU, so I had time to do a more lighthearted... the second book was on Brexit, so... I had just started writing these longer pieces on the website. This is Brexit in Ireland, the dangers, the opportunities, and the untold story of the Irish response or the hidden story of the Irish response. So I had just started writing these analysis pieces on the Saturday morning. Right. And this was just maybe 4 or 5 months after the referendum. So people in Ireland were still trying to get their heads around what Brexit would mean. And there was a general sense that it was not good news for Ireland, but people didn't fully understand the precise implications. And, you know, I must say I didn't either. So I started to kind of get into the subject and started to develop contacts. And I realized I would have to have a completely fresh understanding of the single market and the customs union to see where everything fit. And, you know, I started to develop some good contacts. And of course, you know, I grew up in Ireland. I grew up actually near the border. So I have kind of internalized the conflict in Northern Ireland myself through growing up there. So that gave me a few sort of enviable characteristics and advantages over maybe other journalists from different media, from different countries. And so as I started to write these longer pieces, you know, drawing attention to the contradictions in Britain's initial declarations as to how they were going to handle Brexit and somehow still reconcile the peace process in Ireland, So at that point, Penguin contacted me and said, you know, would I like to write a book on Brexit, trying to explain it to the sort of common punter.
Fantastic in terms of that they contacted you. I'm talking about the whole agent.
I know.
Most of the people writing in Belgium are just, you know, crying out for what do I do?
I hadn't in any sense thought about writing a book, but then when they approached, I thought, let's try and do this. And they talked about bringing this. So this was kind of February 2017, and I think they talked about bringing the book out for Christmas. And I thought, okay, so that means deadline maybe September, October. But actually, they needed the first draft in May. Wow. So that was like, I had about 3 months to write the thing, the first draft. So it was an extremely challenging thing to do. I mean, I had a small child. We had a 6-month-old baby. So it was all extremely difficult to juggle everything. The story was kind of developing as I was writing the book. Obviously, the negotiations began in June of 2017. So it was pretty tough going.
I was just going to say, remind us a bit of the Irish stance, because that I'm not very familiar. Or was it mostly focused on how it would impact the peace agreement and not so much, like, was there a conversation about to the EU, where they were like, no, we're not going to campaign against or anything like that? What was the national?
The Irish government had, you know, before the referendum, had very good relations with the British government. Enda Kenny, who was the Irish Prime Minister, had a very good working relationship with David Cameron. In fact, every year the top civil servants of both countries would meet for a kind of bilateral summit in either Dublin or London, and they would just discuss areas of mutual concern or interest, mostly at EU level. And, you know, these were very good-natured, quite sociable affairs, if my contacts were correct. And there were very close relations between Irish and British diplomats in Brussels. So I think both sets of diplomats and civil servants had been in touch about what this referendum might mean. And the Irish government, I think, identified at quite an early stage that if there was a leave vote, it could cause problems for the Northern Ireland peace process. But I think they were equally worried about bilateral trade between Ireland and the UK if suddenly you had trade barriers, because there was a huge amount of agri-food produce would go from Ireland to the UK. There was the common travel area, which has come up in the news again recently. So the Irish government started to kind of war game what a leave vote might mean. And, you know, across all the civil service, they did a lot of preparation. Each government department had to put forward a contingency plan for what a leave vote might mean. And this was entirely in contrast, very stark contrast with the UK, because the UK didn't do any of that preparation at all on what a leave vote might mean, because the government was campaigning for and presuming that there would be a remain vote. So when the referendum result came in on the 23rd of June 2016, there was a whole system in place in Ireland that kind of kicked in, and they had drawn up papers and preparation papers and position papers. So the Irish government was well prepared for what a leave vote might be.
Were you in Brussels that day?
I remember thinking, like, before the referendum, the more I looked into what a leave vote would mean, just reading the reports and commentary from think tanks and experts, I was thinking, like, why would Britain do this? It's really not in their economic self-interest. The more I came to that conclusion, the more I was hearing anecdotally from people in Brussels who maybe had been in the UK for the weekend and were saying, my God, I met my sister's boyfriend and he's going to vote leave. And they were picking up the sense that the leave vote could actually happen. So you know, and this was increasing as we got closer to the vote.
Yeah.
So, but I remember going to bed about 1 o'clock in the morning, thinking it was going to be a narrow win for Remain.
Yeah.
And then I woke up at 5. My wife, who's also a journalist for a Danish online, she was already up downstairs working. She just called up the stairs, "Honey, yeah, they're right." So that was how my day started.
You're writing this book 6 months after that. And it's before even the official, like, trying.
Yeah, so the book was kind of trying to.
Negotiations were happening.
Yeah.
And how did you even, like, divide it up in your mind? Like,
I mean, I suppose I wanted to sort of give the book a bit of drama. So I sort of started with the night in question. I talked about the fact that in there's a bar in Ukrep where all the staff had a party and they had a playlist reflecting the sense of belonging. So all the tracks that they had, like, you know, "Don't Leave Me This Way" or "Don't Stop Me." You know, I mean, I can't remember exactly, but there's a whole playlist of jokey tunes that reflected this idea of departure or staying or whatever.
Or breaking up.
So it was just trying to convey the drama of the night and the next day. And then trying to look ahead at the problems that Ireland would face. So I looked in great detail about the whole relationship between Britain and Ireland in terms of food, production of food. I mean, in simple terms, it was like the parody of an old-fashioned marriage. Like, Ireland fed Britain and Britain kept Ireland warm at night because Britain provides a lot of the electricity for Ireland. So it was talking to a lot of stakeholders in Ireland who were trying to understand what Brexit would mean, but who had a very good sense of, like, the food relationship between Ireland and Britain. And then the fishing relationship was very close as well, and a lot of Irish fishing boats fish in British waters. What would that mean for them? There was the common travel area, how that all came about. And then there was the kind of inside story of the diplomacy and how Ireland managed to, you know, outsource its national interest to the European Commission and Michel Barnier, and how the EU and member states and the institutions quite readily and willingly took Ireland's case to heart and defended Irish interests, you know, very robustly all the way. So trying to tell a story of how that came about and why it came about, and yet at the same time Ireland had this bilateral relationship with the UK that was very close, and all the tensions that blew up then. So the UK was sort of trying to cozy up to Ireland and say, you know, "Don't worry, we'll not leave you in the lurch," and Ireland saying, "You can't talk to us, we can't have any bilateral negotiation with you, it's only through the EU." And So there, you know, there was a really fascinating and quite suspenseful diplomatic story to be told even within that first 6 months of the negotiations.
What happened to the book since then?
The first draft came out in October 2017. I mean, at that stage, we were still only getting into the negotiations. And then in December 2017, there was this whole crisis around the joint report and this document that both sides had to sign up to, which basically was the embryo of what became the Northern Ireland Protocol and this idea that Northern Ireland could stay in the single market. So I actually broke the story of how the UK had kind of conceded that point. And by breaking the story on RTE, that frightened the Democratic Unionist Party, and they suddenly said they couldn't support it. So there's a whole drama around that. And then that sort of got partially resolved. But all of that happened after the book came out. So very quickly I had to do a second edition, within 4 or 5 months. So I was back at the desk then writing a new chapter and then sort of updating some of the other stuff. So the second edition came out in May of 2018. But I think the publisher felt that, you know, like we couldn't keep bringing out a new edition every time there was a twist and turn in the negotiations. So it ended up the second edition being the last edition. But I mean, certainly I could have, you know, I could be updating it because there were so many twists and turns. I mean, the book did quite well in Ireland, and but I think it sold quite well in Europe as well, because nobody had anticipated the Irish question being so central to the Brexit negotiations. And, you know, even though some people within the institutions had a relatively good grasp of recent Irish history and the peace process, you know, they didn't have a detailed sense of it. And I think they found that my book was a good sort of a handy guide to get into it, you know.
I don't know how many times I've heard that you are the one person who can explain Brexit to anyone. I mean, in Brussels or outside of Brussels, like who actually understands it on top of everything, not only.
I have an albatross around my neck at a certain point.
I'm sure.
But yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, as a journalist, it was a fantastic experience, because there's nothing like that sweet spot where, you know, the more you work at something, the more you become a bit of an expert, or you become an authority on something.
Yeah.
And then that in turn will just mean that if you're approaching officials, then if they know who you are, then they're more likely to perhaps confide or open up and help you with information. Sure. And at the time, a lot of the work I was doing for RTE Online, I was pushing it out through Twitter, and I was reaching an audience then in the UK who were, you know, people who were just looking for another source of information, because they perhaps felt that the British media was somewhat partisan, or, you know, a little bit, you know,
just a tiny bit
in the dark, for example. You know, people in the UK really started to notice my coverage, and that in turn, you know, got more Twitter followers, and I ended up getting invited to address the House of Commons Brexit Committee on three occasions.
What was that like?
I mean, it was just a completely out of body experience. Like the first occasion, I was there physically, and I was called over, so I travelled over to London. I went to a committee room in Westminster, and found myself facing this kind of horseshoe formation of British MPs who were, you know, with my name in front of me. I've seen this so many times on Parliament TV, and suddenly to be there myself was quite a bizarre experience. But it was off the record, so they just wanted to hear what the Irish government was thinking, what the Commission was thinking. So I was able to just give people a sense of where things were at. I mean, they were very nice. I mean, I made some very good connections with some of the MEPs of the committee, and they called me back on two other occasions. But at that stage, it was the pandemic, so it was done online. But then, there was a delegation of MPs came to Brussels then at a certain point, and I sort of did the same performance then. So.
Was it pretty obvious to you, even at an early stage, or maybe not, how the shift from the UK to Irish EU officials would kind of be so present in Brussels, since since the English, like there's a lot of UK citizens who were already working for the institutions, and then they didn't continue, and now there's a whole, it seems to be like the Irish nationals have either taken that place, or I haven't looked at the figures of, did they replace it completely, or was it just was that already kind of shifting?
I think Jean-Claude Juncker, the former Commission President, said straight away that any British officials who were employed in EU institutions would keep their jobs, basically.
Sure.
But they wouldn't
always happen, but yeah.
But they wouldn't be promoted effectively.
Right. Exactly.
So what you had then, you had this very curious phenomenon where there are a lot of British officials who perhaps had an Irish connection, like an Irish grandmother or whatever, and they started to get Irish passports.
Yes.
So then they could rebadge themselves in the institutions, not as British officials, but as Irish officials. which is quite an interesting phenomenon. But it was a bit worrying for the Irish government because they were then taking up positions that could have been taken up by, should I say, genuine Irish citizens. I
don't know, like the Irish officials from...
And, you know, this was coming at a time when there had been a real drop-off in the numbers of new Irish people joining the EU institutions. And that's partly because of just a lack of interest in foreign languages in universities in Ireland, but also because Irish graduates were being snapped up by the multinationals in like the Googles and the Apples, whatever, in Dublin. So there simply wasn't the volume of traffic going to Brussels. I mean, that there is a natural ebb and flow of member states' citizens going to Brussels and getting ahead and getting good jobs, and that's partly to do with when you join the EU. So after Ireland joined in the 70s, there was a kind of a surge of new entrants who by the 2000s, then they were now in top jobs. People like David O'Sullivan, Catherine Day. I mean, now it's the people from Eastern Europe who are rising through the ranks. So that was this is all happening at the same time as Brexit.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to write a book now, today, and who isn't a journalist with a 40-year career or 30-year career?
With a 6-month-old. It was a really exhausting thing for me, but, you know, I'm so glad I did it because writing the book really, you know, was like putting a kind of a sort of an engine thrust on what I was doing because I had to do a deep dive on the granular detail of all this stuff. And that just equipped me then to be an expert on huge parts of the Brexit process. And also, the book gave me sort of credibility and exposure that I wouldn't have had otherwise. So there was a kind of a virtuous circle there in terms of my profile.
So it crystallized a lot of things.
There's nothing to beat the feeling of when a box arrives with your book, the first edition of your book in the post. I mean, I just remember looking at it going, just to see it and feel the physicality of it. Like I don't have a Kindle. I don't like Kindles. I like physical books. So that was just an unbelievable thrill. And so that's what you work for. And then, people around Ireland would be sending me photographs that they would take of people sitting on buses reading my book or whatever, or seeing the book in a bargain basement, who knows.
That's amazing. No, that's perfect. I still haven't managed to finish the book, so I can't even imagine a point where anything might be published apart from what I read in the newspapers 20 years ago. But that's amazing. No, a billion congratulations, Tony. Are you thinking of writing another book, or there's no time now to even breathe about anything?
We'll
see by October at the festival.
I mean, I did a documentary last year on my grandfather who was... This is to do with a political sort of controversy which blew up in Dublin in 2020. So basically, Ireland has been commemorating 100 years of the revolutionary period, going back to, 2014. So there was a whole sequence of events in Ireland, 1914, 1916, which is called the revolutionary period, where Ireland got its independence from Britain. You had the War of Independence, you had the Civil War, and each stage of those events were being marked by a centenary in the 2014, 2016, and so on. Mm-hmm. And in 2020, the government had this idea of commemorating the members of the British police force in Ireland, who were essentially Irishmen, mostly Irishmen, mostly Catholics actually as well. And about 500 of them had been killed in the War of Independence. Policemen were a target for the IRA, who was conducting the War of Independence against the British. But it was called the Royal Irish Constabulary, and it had been set up in the in the 19th century. But the British government had augmented the constabulary with a new special force that were mostly from the UK, and they were, a lot of them were veterans of the First World War. Some of them had slightly questionable pasts, may have had prison sentences. Mm-hmm. And this new force was nicknamed the Black and Tans, and they became synonymous with atrocities against the Irish population. They carried out a lot of reprisals and very murderous acts. So the Black and Tans were, the kind of most cursed part of the British sort of military spectrum in the War of Independence. And so when the Irish government proposed this idea of commemorating the Royal Irish Constabulary, there was a huge backlash because people thought they were going to also commemorate the Black and Tans. And so there was a huge kind of social media backlash. And the government, and this was right before an election, the government kind of panicked and just dropped the idea completely. But my grandfather had been a member of the Royal Irish Constabulary. Mm. And I had known a couple of anecdotes about his life, but not very much. And so after the War of Independence and the constabulary was disbanded, there were very few places for those men to go because they were not really wanted in the new Irish Free State. They weren't wanted in Britain either. They weren't really wanted in the colonies. So my grandfather ended up going to Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland was then the new statelet that had been created after partition, but it was run predominantly by a Protestant majority, and the police force that my grandfather joined was mostly a Protestant police force, yet he was a Catholic from the west of Ireland. I mean, in a way, his life and his family life was symbolic of the great rupture of partition in Ireland. And so on the one hand, the IRA had tried to kill him when he was in Southern Ireland as a policeman during the War of Independence. But then after independence, he became a policeman in predominantly Protestant and Loyalist Northern Ireland. And there he was targeted because he was a Catholic and discriminated against. So I started doing research on his life, and then it became a documentary that was out last year. But part of my research, I came across writing about the fact that around 700 policemen from Ireland ended up going to Palestine through the British Mandate in Palestine, which was undergoing its own colonial sort of crucible at the time. I had thought about writing a book about my grandfather as well, and I went to see a publisher in Dublin last summer, and she said, she was an agent. She just said, look, would you write down like 5 or 6 pages how you think the book would work out and what you would need to do for it? So I wrote it all down. And when I looked at it, I thought, oh my God, that's a huge amount of work. And I've got 2 small kids, and I've got the European elections, and I've got Ukraine and everything. So I just sort of decided to park it for the moment. But
It does sound like the documentary is also probably just as much work as the
documentary. I mean, the documentary was something I could do. I did a lot of the research in my spare time, but it was just such fascinating research to do. I mean, we interviewed my father as part of the documentary.
Oh, brilliant.
But the filming itself took about 2 or 3 weeks altogether in the summertime of 2022.
Yeah.
And then the production company just went back to Ireland and sat in an editing room for like 5 or 6 weeks and produced
this. That was for RT?
It was for RT, yeah.
I have to watch it because I was going to preface our whole conversation by apologizing for my Australian education if I say anything about Ireland that isn't, 100%. But even just in that, I've gotten more of a history lesson than I could have ever imagined. So I will definitely watch it to catch up. I also have to tell everyone... Yeah. To listen to you talking to James Cantor on his podcast, EU Scream, where you guys went through and talked about you know, Palestine, how
the sort of overlap between Ireland and Palestine. Yeah.
Of course, I'm really grateful to you that you've actually been to, like, in the last few months. I know you have to go, it won't be much longer, but where you went to the West Bank, or where were you when you were covering this? Because, of course, I mean, it's almost impossible to understand how these things happen, how they keep going.
And,
you know, that thank God there are journalists that can go that haven't been harmed.
We went to Tel Aviv initially about a month after October 7th and reported on, partly on the Israeli story and the hostages and the politics at that time in Israel, but also reporting on what was happening in Gaza. So, I mean, at that stage, you know, the war had started and there were just every day there were horrific images coming out of Gaza. So I was kind of reporting on both, but doing it from Tel Aviv. Mm. But then we went back in March then, and this time we went to the West Bank and reported on what was happening there in terms of IDF raids on kind of militant areas in the West Bank, but also violent attacks by Jewish settlers on Palestinians, the confiscation of Palestinian land, how that all happens, and the demolition of Palestinian buildings, just kind of how life in the West Bank had just got worse for Palestinians since October the 7th, and also the bigger picture of how an expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank was by degrees making a two-state solution more difficult. So I was trying to tell that story from a kind of ground level, but also the bigger kind of political picture. And then we also had a tour of some of the kibbutzim that were attacked on October 7th with courtesy of the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. You know, even so, we were right down next to the border with Gaza, and you could hear the machine gun fire and the bombs going off from where we were standing in a kibbutz. Mm. But I mean, at that stage, I mean, it wasn't simply telling the story of October 7th, but it was trying to tell that story in conjunction with what was happening in Gaza and talking to the people who had suffered grievously in October 7th to say, well, what you suffered was horrendous, but has the response been justified? You know, you've got, you know, at that stage, over 30,000 dead. You know, is that justifiable? Mm. Or, you know, what do people think? So it was trying to get that sense from Israelis on different parts of the spectrum as to how they felt about the war in Gaza, and then getting the sense in the West Bank. So we had very good fixers and people working with us in the West Bank who really made us, I mean, we got a lot of material at very short notice, and that's all down to the Palestinian fixers that we were working with.
And does it make more sense?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can see certainly, you know, that how settlement expansion in the West Bank is a major problem, and just to see how it happens in real time, it does give you a sense of just the utter sense of despair among Palestinians at their lot and at their plight and the fact that they do have a genuine fear that they are going to be pushed into Jordan or pushed from Gaza into the Sinai Desert.
Mm-hmm.
So we have these existential fears among Palestinians, but of course you have an existential fear among Israelis that Hamas wants to destroy the Israeli state and to carry out another October 7th attack. So you've got these competing existential positions and fear on both sides, which is why it's so difficult for any progress at all to happen.
Yeah. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for sharing that. Did you have any existential angst while you were there, or you were okay?
No, I mean, we never felt at risk, but you know, on one occasion in Tel Aviv, we were traveling out to interview an Israeli professor, and the taxi suddenly stopped at a crossroads and said, out of the car. So we had to jump out of the car and run under some trees, and there were Hamas rockets coming in, or I think it was Islamic Jihad rockets coming in, and we could sort of see them, the Iron Dome interceptors working. But it was quite sort of,
I would say
it was quite unsettling. But of course, in Gaza, people did not have the luxury of having an air defense. So it was kind of a reminder of what it could be, how worse it could be.
I really, really thank you very much for sharing all of this. More on the book, and we'll hear much more about the book in October at the Irish College in Leuven for the Writers Festival of Belgium.
That was Tony Connolly, and I'm Alia Papagiorgiou, who was talking to him from the Writers Festival of Belgium. This podcast was lovingly produced by Paul McNally. Feel free to be in touch if you have any suggestions, recommendations, or authors you need to see. Come to Belgium. This year we'll be at the Irish College in Leuven from October 5 to 6, 2024, and we're very much looking forward to seeing you there and talking all things books and putting them back at the top of your agenda in this exciting election year. Keep writing.